I'm thinking back on it now. Yeah, I should have seen the signs. They were all around me. The omen, because there were, I believe, counting me, this guy who I had met that day who was just supposed to be interviewing for me for a job, but now he was training me. There was him, and then there were two other people he was ostensibly training for the job in the car. So there are four people in the car. I believe it may have been on the fourth day of the month. I don't know. I know that it was on the fourth floor that I met him of this dubious office park out on Blue Lake Drive. I was not the first time I had been to this place. It was this, I suppose, kind of a self-storage spot for offices in transition, businesses that were like on trial, had really yet to get funding, so they were just getting set up and they just needed a place for office space, I suppose, to have like a business line to look somewhat real for investors. I think the last time I'd been into this building was maybe about 5 or 6 years earlier when I was training for Starbucks. At that time, there were only a couple of Starbucks locations in town. And so any of the new baristas, they were training in this office park. And you would go in there and just go into this completely empty bit of office space, and there would just be like AirPods set up with Starbucks coffee in it. You would drink it and sample it and get to know the different tastes, the different notes of the Starbucks coffee. But, you know, I digress. This was several years down the line, and I had worked for Starbucks, and I had left Starbucks, and I had worked for them again and left them again. And now I was unemployed freshly. One of many times in my life that I've been in the situation where I've just been answering any and all opportunities for job interviews that came my way. And back then, even though this is probably about 14 or 15 years ago, as now, it takes a lot to actually meet someone in person who's going to be interviewing you for a job. So if you meet that person, by God, look nice, act professional, and do what they say. Well, that usually is true, except for this one time. I should probably just have stayed home. there were signs all around me that this was a bit of a janky, dubious interview situation. One of these type things. It was like a cattle call audition, essentially. I'd been on these before where you get a call from a company and they make it sound like they looked at your resume and they give you this personalized phone call, and they talk to you about a couple things on your resume, and then they invite you to come in for an interview, and then you find out it's like you and like 30 other people interviewing. This had happened before when this insurance company had called me out of the blue and just went in, because again, I was like fiercely, aggressively unemployed at the time. I was just like, there's this, I could do this, or I could just stay at home and continue to browse like jobs.org or .com or whatever there was. It was like before LinkedIn, but just as scammy as LinkedIn. So I went into this office park that I'd been in here before and went to the fourth floor, which was my first warning. I've always had just a bit of a fear of that number four. The fourth floor, and that put me off a little bit, just as much more than what I really practically should have been put off of this job, just going into this fly-by-night office. There were cubicles all over the place, but there were also just like all these boxes stacked floor to ceiling, you know, like rounding the borders of this office, and you just walked in and there were like 30 or 40 people standing in there. A lot of them are just like in loose fitting suits and misknotted ties, just like me. And you would know who the actual people who worked there were, because they all wore like the same jacket and the same little pin that had the company's logo on it. And I guess whatever they were talking about when I walked in there just had to do something with those boxes, right? So I went in there and just, you know, kind of assimilated, just talked to a few people. Nobody really seemed to know what was going on, but we were looking around and just noticing that this was just a copy and paste kind of office. There was nothing really to distinguish it from any other kind of company. There was no, there were no banners, no graphics on the walls with the company. There weren't even any like mission statements like you get in some company offices. There were just, like I said, cubicles and boxes, and occasionally there was a phone. Some of them were like plugged in to an actual line. There were staplers. It was just like a Hollywood production crew came into this office and just threw a bunch of stuff around that was supposed to be like make it look like an office. And then they had left, you know, because of union rules, they had to go take a lunch or something. So anyway, so from the very beginning was just, I was getting like these kind of weirded out feelings. And before I could really leave and just retreat, this guy comes up to me and he extends his hand out and he says, "Hey, I'm Eddie. You must be Mike." And I was like, "Yeah, I am Mike. Nice to meet you." And I looked down. I had the name tag on my, you know, white shirt that said just like Mike. And, you know, Eddie, I shook his hand. He was one of these guys, was like a lot. He could have been like a football player in like a former life, but like all of that football muscle had turned to football fat. He was lumpy and kind of doughy, approaching middle age. His name was Eddie. And after that, we all got together and he just sort of said some vague things about like what the company does, but not really nailing down any specifics. Again, I'd seen this tactic many times before. And was about to leave, but then he said, "Okay, so I want you guys to come on the interview with me." And he sectioned us off into different people, and he sectioned me into like this pod with two other guys. And before I knew it, before I could really object or say anything, because I suppose I was too nice, we went down, we piled in Eddie's car. And before I knew it, we were on the interstate heading off to, you know, Montgomery, the seat of Alabama government. And I kept on asking him, like, what exactly are we doing today? He's like, "Well, we're going to go sell. You know, this is a sales job, so I'm actually going to show you what the job is, and then you're going to take it over, and I'm, you know, you're going to sell for me, in front of me. We're going to see if you have what it takes." Okay. So again, I was in the car. I guess I had just sort of, for all practical reasons, been kidnapped, but I could have left at my own volition, but it would have been bad form in a job interview to like accuse the person who's interviewing you of kidnapping you. So I just went with the flow. Again, what was behind me? Well, it was like my hometown, and it was like a, you know, computer opened up to a job site full of like other jobs that I could be looking through. So it's like, whatever, I don't have anything to lose, right? Literally nothing else to do. Which, you know, as turns out, was a really bad philosophy, you know, because 3 hours later I was being detained in a government building, questioned with my new boss about our wares. Federal agents had descended on us because they kept questioning what we were selling, and my new boss, I guess, because by that time I suppose I had the job, because it looks really bad and he's really apologetic the whole time to me as we're waiting for these federal officers to question us. He said, "Man, I'm really, really sorry. Listen, if you want the job, you got it. This is He could have given me the keys to his car at that point, right? Only he couldn't because they had taken them. You know, it was just this thing where we had been going around Montgomery all day long trying to sell these coupon books, which, funny enough, was probably the first job I ever had. You know, like, I was in the band in the sixth grade, and in order to raise money for us to go to, like, state competition, we had to go door to door and sell these coupon books. And, you know, there's $30,000 of value in this coupon book, right? That's what we had to say over and over again. And yeah, this is whatever it was, like 18 years later, we were using the same lines. Only the people were not as nice as, like, my neighbors that I grew up with and went to church with. They were like, get out. Did you see the sign on the door? There's no solicitation. And just crestfallen, my boss, who just really thought this was, like, such a great idea, you know, like, Eddie, great business idea to get into, said, well, nobody else, none of these other, you know, companies will let us in to sell these coupon books. Let's go over to that building over there. And I, at that point, said to, like, I'm pretty sure you're not allowed to solicit to federal employees. And he's like, what are you talking about? I've been doing this 15 years. Come on over here. And sure enough, you know, like, we went in there and we had to, you know, he should have been, like, tipped off, and we had to, like, take our shoes off and, like, belts and move through the metal detectors and all that, go through security, you know. And we went up to the front office and we asked for, like, security clearance so that we could get up there and start, you know, like, you know, going to the different offices, these different government offices, door to door, and selling, like, coupon books for, you know, like, free oil changes and, you know, quesadillas and I don't know what. And yeah, they just told us to wait right there, right? And so we waited right there for about 2 hours. And eventually these, officers, these guys in uniform, you know, they came down and they started, like, inspecting us, and they started looking through all the different coupon books, you know, of which we had, like, a satchel full, right, that was on one of those, like, dollies, those pull carts that you take around. And yeah, that was, as I said, at that point, you know, like, a few hours later or so, we were able to leave. It was a very thorough investigation, and we were able to leave Montgomery. And yeah, like, on the way home, he said, like, listen, man, thank you so much for this day. Do you want something to eat? And I said, no, I don't want anything to eat. And he's like, I got a lot of coupons, man. We could use one of those. And I said, no. He's like, do you want a job? And I said, no, I don't want the job. I apologize. Thank you very much for this very interesting experience, right? And yeah, I looked behind it. I counted them, including me. There were four people from the fourth floor of the dubious office park on, as I said, like, I think what should have been, would have been maybe the number, the fourth day of the month, right? Yeah. I should have heeded the warning. I've always had a fear of that number four, right? And, yeah, this week I found out, yeah, I'm not the only one. Learned these lessons over the years in looking for a job, that the physical space, just as much as the metaphysical one, is always important, something that you definitely need to you know, look out for, without a doubt. Speaking of good metaphysical space as well as physical ones, yeah, this is Mike Booty. This is the Midnight Citizen Show. Welcome. Welcome to the show. I'm back in the studio this week. Good to be here. I don't know if you're listening. Where you're listening, Spotify, Apple Music, the Substack, right? But I'm there, and it's good to be back with you. This is my first show back in the studio now, I suppose, in like, 3 weeks or something like that. Yeah, it's been a bit of a tailspin, as I'll talk a little bit about tonight. I don't want to give away too much, but we have been I think yo-yoing is maybe the best term for it, I could say. Just like down to the end of our rope and all the way back up again, and at various points in between, just stranded and dangling here in Birmingham, Alabama, in the second week of May, 2025. I don't want to be alone, so leave a comment, rate the show. That would be so helpful. Give me a little bit of love on the Midnight Citizen Show. Yeah, I just think about these things, about all these times in my life that I've just been stranded between positions of employment. And as I've been talking about, this is becoming like a full-blown saga of the show. This constant yo-yoing of gainful employment and seeking it. And just going back and forth. And there have really been, after something like 100 job applications and resumes and cover letters, really 3 prospects. And none of them have come from LinkedIn at all. You know, 3 prospects there. You know, one of them, I've interviewed for all 3 of them. One of them I did not get after 1 screening interview. The next one I went in and interviewed for in person and then did not get a couple of days later. Now I'm just waiting for 1 more, right? And then after that, it's just like, I suppose, back to whatever drawing board it is, right? But it's been quite a journey these last few weeks. I went on an interview this week, which was really my first in-person interview. I don't count, as I said, I've had, like, including the one that I had on Thursday, I've had like 2 in-person interviews in the last couple of weeks. And it's so weird because I think I talked about this on last week's show, that I had an in-person interview a couple of weeks ago, but I thought that I had actually already had the job, and I'm not like being arrogant or anything like this. I'm not being cocky, but it was a contact that I had developed through a colleague who, like said that they're looking for somebody, like a teacher who can work with some kids for a couple weeks during summer camp. And I emailed them, and I went in and talked to them in person, and there was never any indication throughout that it was an actual job interview. I genuinely just thought it was like something that I was going to do because it was like in teaching, and I had all this experience, and it was something that had been set up, like, like a contact that I'd made through work. And so I guess the only reason I think I did not get that is because I did go in, and as I said, it was like temporary work. And so I suppose I went in and told them at the very beginning of the interview that I'm looking for permanent work right now. So if that happens, we may not be able to work together. So I was just like completely upfront. So I think that that's why I didn't get it, but still, right. It would have been nice to, maybe have that, but it's no issue because it was like for 2 weeks in the second the last part of June, and then a few days after that, I got a call from, actually got a text message from an old from a fellow teacher at the old high school that I used to work with, asking me if I could come in and, you know, teach summer camps during those weeks. So it evened out in that sense. So that's good. So I've got work right now lined up for June. Although it is temporary, I've got two summer camps I'm teaching now in June, so that's good. But nothing for May right now. Like right now, May is just like a blank slate of me just delivering food, driving around, just doing that, and interviewing for jobs. Yeah, so you know, and waiting to hear back from interviews that I've had. So yeah, just yo-yoing around. And surfing. Yeah, I've given the name to like the fictional company that will hire me, just like the amalgam of whatever, Yo-Yo Dine Industries, I think is the name. I think it's just because I've been reading V by Thomas Pynchon. I've been going through Thomas Pynchon's books lately, just to anticipate his latest book that's coming out this fall, Shadow Ticket. And so yeah, I've been going back to V. And V has this mysterious toy company that becomes a government contractor in the pages of the novel called Yo-Yo Dine Industries. And name, because I believe the signature toy of the company was the it's actually the gyroscope, right? But the main character in the novel, Benny Profane, is described as the human yo-yo. And according to Thomas Pynchon, like, yo-yoing is the art of just wandering aimlessly, right? From place to place, taking up odd jobs, just whatever you can do. Couch surfing, hence the surf music. I'm not couch surfing, I actually have a place of my own, but you know, just the art of yo-yoing is just to be back and forth between different states of stability. So I suppose, you know, that's what I'm doing right now. Yeah, not that I'm not preparing for the event that I do not get this job that I interviewed for this week. Right. No, I am continuing to look on LinkedIn. Yes, I am. For jobs. Right. You know, like this week I saw a post from the Vatican looking for they were looking for like somebody to be in like a management position, but started to fill out my cover letter there, and before I could send it in, it was taken by some guy from Chicago. God dang it. Yeah, so here I am, just yo-yoing around town, delivering food for food. And really trying to do the best job at it that I like possibly can. And, you know, delivering food is, I've been doing it now for what, like 6 years now. I started right before COVID, and this is never really something I've done I did not start doing food delivery just because I needed the money, although, you know, the money's nice. Like, you know, like, what's that Sally Struthers, right? Didn't she used to say that? Like, do you want to make more money? Sure, we all do. Yeah. I wanted to make more money back when I was teaching. That was always nice, but it was more just to get in the car and just, as I've said many times before, just like drive around the city, like listen to music, listen to podcasts, just like be in my world and make money, in a fairly, easy fashion, you know? But I do take a lot of pride in being like a very good, efficient delivery driver, whereas a lot of people are not, right? You go and you're constantly working with all these people who are just, you know, people who are hopping in the car trying to make a buck as quick as possible, being very, really inconveniencing a lot of people. A very common thing here in Birmingham, especially when you're delivering downtown, is for these food delivery drivers just to park in the middle of the road so that cars have to go behind them so that they could put their, a lot of times they don't even put their emergency, you know, flashers on, but they just very, very quickly just like, you know, park and they run into the restaurant and, you know, their idea is to get the food really quick and then run right back before anybody is inconvenienced by having to go around their car that's parked in the middle of the road. But it doesn't always, almost never works out that way. They always just like leave their car there without the flashers on, and that's just, they're just doing a bad job. They're just inconveniencing people, right? But they're also, they can be really rude to the people who work in the restaurants, and they cannot be very efficient to customers. Like, we've had, my wife and I have ordered food many times, and we've just had these delivery drivers just not do a good job at being able to like read a freaking GPS and just be able to tell where our car, our houses, even though we give them like really good notes, really efficient notes. They will go to the wrong side of the building. They'll actually throw our food up on the porch and just like leave, right? And they'll deliver the wrong order to us. So it may not sound like it because it sounds like a pretty easy job, but there are many, many ways to screw up even what seems like an easy job, right? So I always try to be like the best driver I can be because, you know, as I've been doing it now for 6 years, I've been employed at other jobs consistently, you know, in all that time. But like right now, this is one of the few times that this is all I've been doing, really, right? Until I start teaching summer camp in a couple of weeks, this is the only thing I'm doing. It's just delivering food. So I always get a good, you know, just like good impression of myself if I'm doing a job well. So I want to be able to do this job as well as I can. So, yeah. And yeah, so that's what I do. I go around and in the different restaurants, I like to try and if I can, identify the workers, the employees, the people who are scrambling to make sure that I have the food on time and the customer has the food on time. I try to identify them by name, look them in the eye, smile at them, thank them very much for what they do. If I can, like give them a tip because I'm getting tipped and I want to be able to pass that on to them. You know, but also the customers as well. When you deliver food every day, you start to have this like ordinary group of customers, but you know, as I think I've identified before, right? When you're making house calls, which often you are with food delivery, when you're making house calls, these ordinary customers are not ordinary people, so they can be a little odd. A lot of them, like you never ever see, right? A lot of the customers that you deliver food to, they prefer, and this goes back to COVID. Right. They prefer contactless delivery. So you just put the food at their door and then they at some point open the door and take the food. It's like that movie Burnt Offerings, really. Okay. But then again, some customers like my guy, Mike, and I get the feel his name's Mike C. That's all I know of him. And I get the feeling that that's not his real name. I get the feeling that he's trying to, like, you know, that name plus the last name initial is some kind of like a dirty joke or something. I get that feeling about Mike just from his personality. But, you know, he's one of these customers who is housebound. He lives in an apartment. And I deliver to him just about every day from different places, you know, from Chick-fil-A, from Jimmy John's, Jersey Mike's, Chipotle, McDonald's. Just bring him food. And I know that Mike is will always open the door and he'll always want to talk to me. And which is fine, but I mean, sometimes it's awkward because I'm in the middle of a rush. I have to get away pretty quickly. And he's not one of these guys who picks up on social cues very well. So it's like I have to use all of the tricks and strategies that I use with students from years of teaching to try and get out of conversations, making them feel like, you know, they were heard, I suppose. Right. And, you know, so, yeah, like Mike is one of these guys who has revealed to me he's had a history of substance abuse, lost his license, can't leave the house. I get the idea maybe there's like some kind of a bit of a house arrest situation going on, but always wants to talk to me about Aleister Crowley. And when I go to his apartment, he always has these like cryptic notes pasted on the wall, like the devil's going to make him do it. Things like that. These ordinary things that should, like the number four to me, should frighten many people. But no, I think he's relatively harmless. I think he is, right? And so, yeah, I'm always like a good guy trying to be the best person I possibly can to Mike. Trying to take all that energy into the focus that I would in my normal day as a teacher. But now that I'm not teaching anymore, now that the semester's over, all of that usual focus on being the best I can at my job goes into delivery driving, and that includes attending to Mike and what are his best needs, right? So, like, a good example, I'll show you what I mean, is a few weeks ago going to his house, and he comes out, and he's just, like, saying, like, man, I'm going nuts in there. Like, I don't, it's like, do you have a cigarette? Do you have a cigar? And I said, like, no, I'm sorry, man. I don't smoke really that much anymore. And he says, that's okay, man. It's like, I don't even have anything to read. You got anything to read? And I said, no, I don't. But I put that in my back pocket, right? So the next day I draw Mike's name again, and I'm prepared for it this time. So I go to Mike's house, and I take him his order of Chipotle, and he comes to the door. And I pull out from behind my back, I've got a surprise for you. And I gave him this this anthology of American literature, this thing that this book that I had gotten in the break room in the English department at the university where I've been teaching all semester. And just this anthology of American literature that somebody put in there just to be taken, that they didn't need it anymore. So I took it and I just have it. And it's got all these, like, you know, stories. It's got the entire catalog of American literature, a survey of the great writers, you know, all the way from the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson and all that stuff, all the way up to like Kurt Vonnegut, right? So it's got a lot of stuff in there for him to read. So I show it to him and I'm like, here, man, I don't need this anymore. It's just been collecting dust in my back seat. And he looks at it and he just kind of observes it, and he takes the Chipotle and then the book, and he sort of like looks it over and he's like, okay, thanks, man. That's great. And I said, well, yeah, remember you said you wanted something to read, you know, that's got a bunch of stories in it. And he's like, yeah, yeah. I was, when I said that, I was really thinking like Hustler or something like that. So I said, oh, well, I'm not really sure, where to even buy Hustler. Do they still publish that magazine? And all that is like, no, man, it's cool. You did your best. It's like, I'll check out the book. Okay. Yeah. Thanks, man. Thanks. So that kind of, that was like the one time it was like weird. Like he had left the conversation before I could, right? It wasn't one of these things where he was like standing on his balcony, continuing to talk to me about Aleister Crowley and right? Like what better substance is best and things like that before I could leave. So thank you. So I drove off and this week I went back yet again. I delivered him like McDonald's with a black coffee and went up to his door, knocked on it. He didn't come to it before I could get up there. He just kind of, you know, sort of sadly opened it up. He didn't have to. Could have done a contactless delivery just like everybody else, but wanted to open it up. And he said like, "Hey man, thanks, thanks." And he just looked like he was a little bit deflated. And he said, "You know, I just wanted to let you know, I read that Black Cat by Edgar Allan Poe." I said, "Oh yeah, that's a good one. The guy's cat, the guy kills a cat." He's like, "Yeah, it was pretty good. Thanks." So I know. I should have brought him an apple turnover, black coffee from McDonald's and a copy of Hustler. I know. So well, I mean, I just can't. There's just some things I can't be the best at something, right? I can't meet every demand, I suppose. Yeah, I know. But anyway. But yeah, here we are on a Saturday night. And normally I record shows on Friday night, I know. And believe me, I was all set up to do one last night. I just came home and absolutely crashed because, you know, just all week long we've been my wife and I have been going back and forth to what we just call Lakeshore. It's on Lakeshore Parkway, but this is where the rehabilitation facility is for people undergoing all types of physical rehabilitation. And this is where my mother-in-law has been all week long, because you know, as I previously mentioned, a couple weeks ago I was camping with some friends. I went up, we had our annual cabin trip up there in the mountains in Georgia, and I got up there really late on Friday night because my mother-in-law had come to town a couple days earlier, and my wife was in a show. Jessica was doing a show downtown, and my mother-in-law Jean Marie really wanted to see it. So, she drove down there and all that. So, but Jean Marie is a wonderful person. It's like I grew up my entire life having this like Tim Allen like home improvement vision, I suppose, of the mother-in-law. You know, like this mother-in-law monster-in-law kind of thing where it's like you're not supposed to get along with your mother-in-law. She's supposed to hate you and everything you stand for because you married her daughter and you're not worthy of her and all that stuff. Jean Marie and I have never ever had that kind of tension. It just from the very beginning we just got along really well, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that. Like Jean Marie is you know, into the arts. She's an actress just like Jessica is, and a teacher just like I am. So we always just, you know, and Jessica is also, and we just all get along really well. We've always got along, but you know, for the last few years, of course, Jean Marie has had some mobility issues because she had a knee replacement surgery and all that. And like, you know, Friday she had come into town not only to see Jessica be in a show, but also to get, she had a doctor's appointment with her, geriatric doctor, who was looking at things like just following up on the knee replacement and all that stuff. So I was with Jean Marie on Friday night. We went and saw Jessica's show and everything was fine. And then Jean Marie was staying with my parents here in town. And, after Jessica's show, I, dropped Jean Marie off and I, you know, drove up to the mountains and got there about 1 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, Saturday morning, just like woke up and I just got this text from my dad that said, "Please call me now." Right. So my God, you know, that's just, I'm just saying, like, there are times where it's like you get to this thing where it's like there are ages, right, that you are approaching where you can expect to get texts like this more and more, or calls like this, right? And things are going through your mind, like somebody died, one of my grandparents passed away, or, you know, something like that, or worse, right? And so I called my dad, and I couldn't get him on the phone. It went to voicemail, and then I called my wife, and I couldn't. It went to voicemail, so I'm like, "What's going on?" And so I make the decision to just get in the car because I can't really just sit there while something obviously has gone on back in Birmingham. And, you know, I get in the car and drive to Trenton, the nearest town, which is about, you know, 10 minutes away, just to get a cup of coffee. And on my way to Trenton, I finally get a call from my mom, which immediately makes me happy because, like, my dad texting me, "Please call me now," is like, something's wrong with mom, but now mom's calling me. Okay, this is good. And so she's calling me, and she tells me that Jean Marie had taken a fall. She had taken a nasty fall that morning over at their house. And she had to be rushed to the hospital, and she's going into surgery. They don't really know exactly everything that's going on. So, of course, I have to immediately turn the car around and go all the way back to Birmingham, which is a 2-hour drive. But still, the whole way, of course, I'm sweating and thinking and all that. And just, it's one of these moments where, you know, you're trying to process so much information, but your mind and your body is still wanting to do the normal thing. Right. So I think to even out things, or to try and rationalize, or to sort of still stick with this delusion that things are normal and ordinary and fine. Maybe that's what's going on. I'm not sure. But so I continued to Trenton and get my coffee. I get my cup of coffee. Right. And I go back to the campsite, and I unfortunately have to say goodbye to my friends. I have to say, like, I'm really sorry about this. They of course, like, totally understood. They're like, "Yeah, go back." And, you know, and they're good friends. They're good people, because they continue to check in on things, you know, throughout the weekend. So, but I get in my car and I go back, and again, my mind and my body still wanting to stick with the normal things. I stick with doing the tradition that I've always done, you know, for years and years, especially with my wife, whenever we travel across state lines into ordinary states where they have the lottery. I stopped at a gas station and refilled on coffee, and I bought a lottery ticket, a scratch-off lottery ticket, you know, for my wife, just to take it back to her, because I know, of course, that Jessica is going to be beside herself dealing with whatever had happened to Jean Marie at this point. Remember, I still do not know. So get back that Saturday night, Saturday afternoon, and go into the emergency room, and, you know, we're there. And I'm sure if you're listening to this and you're, you know, at some point we all got to go to the emergency room, right? Either as a patient or the family member or friend of a patient. And you know that the emergency rooms, they're like, you know, they, weird communities sprout up around them, right? You know, everybody comes into the emergency room at the same time, and just for the next several days, and possibly beyond that, in some cases, you just see the same people. They're all there for, you know, the same people who came in at the same times, right? And so we see several people over the next few days, right? The family that came in with the husband and the father and the son who had just been in a motorcycle accident, right? The person who had just been like an intense, they were in the burn unit, so something bad happened with them, and fire, I'm sure, right? And we don't probe for too many details, but we know each other, you know? Like, I know Orlando now. We kept seeing each other, passing each other on the elevator, right? So we go into the emergency room, and we know what happened. So, like, Jean Marie had broken her femur, and it seems like she had broken that, like, put her leg out as a matter of breaking her fall, because she lost consciousness for some reason. She had gotten this really bad vertigo and had lost consciousness and broken her femur, and also hit her head, and there was a brain bleed, which is just about the worst thing that I've ever heard. Like, brain, which is the most important part of the body, right next to the word bleed. So there's like this awful alliteration going on there, right? But that wasn't the worst thing. It was really, it just seemed like it was the femur. So she had to go into surgery for that. So, you know, again, over the next couple of days, we are just all like kind of, you know, yo-yoing, I don't know, like around the hospital at UAB, just going from the ER to pre-surgery to surgery and back to the room where she finally was, and then getting her into the rehab facility down at Lakeshore. And then she went back to UAB yesterday for a follow-up CT scan. And while we're waiting for those results, essentially everything is more or less stable, and we're going to now hopefully get her to her sister's house in Georgia where she can continue the recovery. So that's everything that's been going on in like the past 2 weeks. And again, I'm sure a lot of people out there can probably relate to this story that I'm telling. I've never had to go through it personally, but it is one of those things that I do. I believe, you know, if you're like me and you're going through, you know, time and you're worrying that as you get older, you're spending not as much time as you should with your family members. Well, I've got, in a weird way, kind of some good news for you. Each one of those family members will eventually probably go in for an extended period of stay in a hospital or some kind of a recovery center, and you'll have all the time in the world that you need to spend with them, because that's been the ultimate question the past couple of weeks that my mother-in-law has been asking. Is like, I can't understand why this kept happening, why this happened to me now. I was doing so well, and indeed she was, right? She was going to the gym like every day in Savannah, Georgia, where she lives. She was driving all over the place. She's just a very active senior citizen. And the only thing that I could tell her, and again, I'm not as religious as she is, but I feel like I am quite spiritual. And I do believe that there is some kind of a narrative that we're meant to discover for our lives. And I just told G. Marie, I think like the reason this happened is because it happened here in Birmingham where you have family. If it happened in Savannah where you have some friends but not family, we would not have been able to give you this level of attention and care and be with you this much. It's like every day for the last 2 weeks, somebody from my family, if not me, Jessica, if not Jessica, then me, or my parents were with her today, were able to sit with her for hours on end and just be able to keep her company and catch up with her and see her in a way that did not revolve around holidays and presents and just like going and having a quick lunch before she had to, you know, get in the car and go back to Savannah, Georgia. So it's like it's oddly been like a time that has been birthed out of like a tragedy in a scary situation, but has nevertheless brought us, I believe, you know, kind of very, very much close together. Right. And, you know, I think I just told her that I think that that's like what's going on. That's what's happening. So that's why she's in this situation. Yeah. So. Yeah, and the things that it's just been making me realize about life, I think like just being in a hospital will get you thinking about those big questions. Like there's no question about it. You will start bugging out about the eternal mysteries. You know, this one realization I had, and I think this is because I was talking with her geriatric doctor as I said, the man who had seen her on Friday, right before she took the fall, Saturday morning, you know, came in and we were talking, and I was telling him, like, this crazy thing that had happened, that I told him, like, I am not a religious person, but if I were, I would think that God was probably punishing me. And he said, like, well, that's a very selfish thing to say. He didn't really say that. Like, I thought that. That's kind of selfish on you. Again, this is one of the reasons why I'm not religious, because it's like it narrows everything down to you. Well, it's not all about you. Right? But I would say that God is punishing me. And I told him this, and he said, well, why is that? And I said, well, because, like, you know, the Friday at the campsite before I got there to see my friends, you know, one of my friends who was there, he had woken up that morning, and he had taken a nasty spill down the hill, and narrowly probably avoided going to the emergency room, but it seemed like everything was kind of, all the cuts and bruises were superficial. And when my friends told me about it later on, I laughed at them. And I feel like me laughing at him perhaps pretended or caused this terrible incident that happened to my mother-in-law. And the geriatric doctor said, like, you know, that's perfectly normal. For me, there's two stages in life: when you laugh at people when they fall, and then when you call 911 when they fall. And I think just right now you're, like, between those stages. So yeah, maybe that's true. It's like, if God was telling me anything, it's like, you know, stop laughing and when somebody falls, and just, like, take it more seriously. Maybe that's it. But you know, it did get me thinking about the idea that you know, being up, like, you know, be standing up and moving gracefully from point A to point B, you know, is, if you think about it, not really like a normal thing for us to do. It's like, that is not a default thing for us as humans to do. Like, yes, we can do it for, like, a select period of life, but really our natural state is to be flat, or is to fall and to be clumsy. And you know, because, yeah, I was thinking about the idea that, like, a third of our lives are spent sleeping, right? The other third of our lives are spent at work, which means for most of us, we're sitting down at a desk. So that means, like, the other third of our lives is what, like, you know, is that? Yeah, I can't do math. But the other part of our lives is possibly getting up and moving between those two things, right? But we only really get to do that for, like, what, maybe 70 years of our lives? Okay, so, like, it takes a lot of effort for us to, as infants, like, get up and, like, kind of crawl and move back and forth, right? And eventually, like, our body just gives out on that idea. And when we go to the hospital, that is, like, an entire, you know, infrastructure devoted to defying this unnatural thing we do, which is to walk. And so just, like, walking around the hospital, you're just seeing all these people in wheelchairs. And, you know, I swear, looking at you, not like it with envy at all, like, as you're moving gracefully back and forth in and out of the Starbucks. But you know, just, like, grimacing, like, you know, like, yeah, yeah, I see the way you're looking at me. Yeah, this is going to be you pretty soon. You know, you're going to be in here just like me. And Yeah, as I said, there was on the, we were on the elevator, yo-yoing is like up and down. Jean Marie was on the fifth floor. She would have been on the fourth, but there was no fourth floor, and I was mystified by that. I was so confused by why there was no fourth floor. And I was talking about this at the end of my show last week, and you know, thanks to Lynn, I may have found an explanation for this. So my wife Jessica and I, just over the few 3 or 4 days that Jean Marie was in the hospital before she moved to rehabilitation, we were asking everybody we could from all walks of the hospital, from every bit of its hierarchy, all the way from the parking lot attendants to the doctors, why there was no fourth floor. Like, why you got into the elevator and you could push the buttons for 1, 2, 3, and 5, but there was no 4. And nobody could answer us. Nobody. And obviously, a lot of them had been asked these questions before, and they had taken it in stride to, like, sort of, like, crinkle up their brows and look all mysterioso. But they said, like, no, seriously, I really don't know. Right. So I had, like, my theories, of course. Of course, the fun theory, the theory that I want it to be, is that that's like where they keep the government experiments, the pigmen and what have you. The coupon book salesmen that they detain and stuff like that to experiment on. I don't know. But less popular theories, but just as real. Maybe the morgue. I don't know. But some... I think I read on Reddit, because there's a whole discussion thread on Reddit about it, about why there's no fourth floor at UAB, and I don't know if this goes for other hospitals. I don't know. Let me know. Tell me. But, yeah, it at the University Hospital, no fourth floor because it's a new building, and to match the old buildings up with the new buildings, and certain wings of those buildings, they have to keep the floors in line. So that's why there's no fourth floor. But there's no fourth floor on any of them. So I looked, right? So, yeah, Lynn gave me a comment last week. And she said, well, in Asian culture, the number 4 sounds like the Japanese word for death. And so... many Asian buildings do not have fourth floors. And so this is perhaps the best explanation I could get, right? And there's a name for this. And I've totally forgotten it all of a sudden. It's going to be the name for this episode. Why can't I remember it all of a sudden? Tetraphobia? Is that it? Tetraphobia. Yeah. Which is the fear of 4, right? From ancient Greek, 4, tetris, 4 in ancient Greek, fear, is the practice of avoiding distance in instances the digit 4. It's a superstition that is most common in East Asian nations and is associated with death, right? You see, it's like it's from Asia, right? Yeah, the Chinese word for 4 sounds quite similar to the word for death. So the Chinese word for 4 is pinyin, and the Chinese word for death is also pinyin. So they're like, what, homonyms, right? Or homophones in many varieties of Chinese. Tetraphobia is known to occur in Korea and Japan, since the two words sound identical, but not at all in Vietnam because they carry different tones. Yeah. So in mainland China, it says Chinese is a tonal language with a comparatively small inventory of permitted syllables, resulting in an exceptionally large number of homophone words. Many of the numbers are homophones or near homophones of other words. Okay. So, and yeah, on the Wikipedia page, there's a button, or there's a picture of an elevator panel that looks very similar to all the ones at UAB in the UAB elevators at the hospital. This is an elevator control panel in a residential apartment building in Shanghai with no floor numbered as the fourth. So they also show a picture of a parking lot with numbered spaces. The number four is missing in a parking lot in Japan. So this may have something to do with it. The fact that there's just this fear of the number four in places like Japan, right? And Hong Kong and all that. And I don't know why it's transferred to the medical establishment at the university hospital here in Birmingham, but this is like the best thing I can think of is that, you know, whoever designed the elevators or whoever approved the elevators or whatever, you know, at the hospital has a fear of the number four, you know, just like I do. Right. And what is fascinating is that, I spent a lot of time on the elevator at the university hospital in the past couple of weeks, going up and down, yo-yoing back and forth. I just observed like a lot of things in there, and one of those things that you start looking at is you start actually looking at the operator, the certificate that's in placed in the conveyance. That shows that the elevator is safe to use. And on the bottom line, it has the signature of the chief inspector for the county on there. And I looked at there and the name looked very familiar to me. And I thought about it for a few minutes and I was like, oh my gosh, that is Eddie. That's the name of the guy who once interviewed me years ago at that dubious office park to go to government buildings in Montgomery and sell coupon books with them. Like it was the same, it was Eddie. And then it was the same exact last name. Right. So I was like, oh my gosh, is this what he's been doing all these years? Did he leave the coupon book business behind and become an elevator inspector? And not only that, but did his, bad experience with the number four on that day many years ago in Montgomery inform his same tetraphobia, his same fear of the number four? Is that what happened? Right. So of course I Googled him and I looked him up and, I was like, is this the same guy? Right. And, sure enough, conspiracy or synchronicity be damned. It was not. I looked at him. I found him in a copy of Elevator World magazine, you know, dedicated to the craft, the fine art of vertical conveyance. Saw a picture of him, did not recognize him. This is a different guy. And I guess it is a fairly common last name, I suppose. But I like to think that there was something in there to tie my life together in some weird way. I'm not sure what it was. And also, you know, to end this podcast with some kind of like narrative thematic theme, but you know, alas, I don't think so. It goes with my belief that the world, our lives, our narratives are quite entropic, that every once in a while we have a little bit of a synchronicity, some kind of narrative meaning dangled in front of us, but it ultimately really doesn't mean anything. So, sorry to disappoint. Anyway, thank you so much for joining me here tonight on the Midnight Citizen Show. I want to remind you once again, you can find me over at mikesbonfire.substack.com. And also follow me over at Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Please follow me over on Spotify. That's actually where I'm publishing the show these days. And it really helps if you rate the show, give it a review, get other people to listen to it and see it. If you think that it's good enough to be shared, then share it. That would be awesome. And I'm also over at the Overnight Scape Underground at onsug.com, where you can hear me and a lot of other great monologists, podcasters, I suppose. I'm over there as well. Yeah. Tetraphobia, the fear of the number four. I've never liked that number. I just never have because, you know, I think just growing up, there were five people in my family, five including me, right? So I always felt like if there was the number four, then it was not complete. Something was left out, right? I don't know. So, but now I guess if you consider my family plus my wife and my mother-in-law, you know, that's six. So five would now be the unlucky number, which, oh shit. Jean Marie was on floor number five. Okay. All right. Well, we'll stick with four. We'll stick with tetraphobia and that'll be all right. All right. Keep your eyes open.